From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Rhiannon Giddens is a singer and songwriter. She plays the banjo and the fiddle. She's a storyteller, activist, and musical historian. She's also a founding member of the Grammy Award-winning Carolina Chocolate Drops, inducted into the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame in 2016. Last year, Rhiannon Giddens won a MacArthur Genius Award of $625,000 for what the foundation calls her reclamation of African-American contributions to folk and country music and her illumination of new connections between music from the past and the present. MacArthur Fellows, by the way, are nominated and cannot apply for the prestigious award. There are also no strings attached to the money. Despite that freedom, or perhaps because of it, Rhiannon Giddens is composing a musical that tells the story of the only known coup d'etat in American history, which took place in Wilmington, North Carolina, 120 years ago this November 10th. That was the day armed white men drove people of color out of government, out of their homes, and out of town. Basic facts around the event, including the actual death toll, are still murky. So Giddens is working with historians and American essayist John Jeremiah Sullivan to piece together some of those still disputed facts. She has produced two solo albums, Tomorrow Is My Turn in 2015 and her most recent work, Freedom Highway, just last year. Both feature songs that explore the experiences of people who were slaves and the struggles of people of color during what we popularly call the Civil Rights era. She joins us to talk about her work, the day she plays Keenan Auditorium on the campus of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington at 7:30 this Wednesday evening. Rhiannon Giddens, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we are inviting you to join the conversation. What have you always wanted to ask this MacArthur genius? You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Rhiannon Giddens, tell us about the first time you heard about the 1898 coup d'etat. Where and how did you learn about it?
I can't remember. I even think it may have been John Sullivan who told me about it as we were talking, because he was doing a story on me for something completely unrelated, and although everything is related, I'm finding. But I was kind of like, what, you know? And if I had known about it, it would have been a very vague kind of thing, but that's the moment that I remember kind of it becoming in sharp focus and then learning about what happened and kind of going, I cannot believe I didn't know about this. I cannot believe that I wasn't taught this as a North Carolinian. We spent a year on North Carolina in schools is what I remember, and I don't remember a word of this, you know, and I was just kind of so blown away that it just immediately became a big focus for me.
And you, as you said, you're a North Carolinian. Mm-hmm. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Greensboro, and I was raised sort of in Greensboro and then in towns like McLeansville and Julian around Greensboro, so sort of rural-urban mixture, you know, but very, very, very firmly Piedmont, you know, very, very firmly North Carolina.
So aside from telling this story of a critical part of North Carolina, indeed a critical part of American history, and kind of addressing this omission from the textbooks, how do you see the story changing our current cultural narrative? What is the legacy of 1898?
Well, I like to say it's restoring our history and our legacy. You know, we're not changing anything. We're actually uncovering and putting it in its rightful place, because if we, you know, that there's the old saying, if you don't know, you know, what you don't know, you're doomed to repeat, you know. And I feel like, especially considering the political climate right now and considering the disenfranchisement that's been going on, sort of boldly been going on, and the redistricting that's been going on all over the country, you know, the gerrymandering, all of that sort of thing, I think it's really important to restore this, you know, in its place in American history, because it is so big and it had such repercussions, and the repercussions are still being felt today, you know. And I think that's just really important, because people, they just, you know, when they realize that this is actually centuries in the making it becomes more immediate. It's like, oh, actually, this isn't just kind of happening. No, this is actually part of a pattern that's been going on for a long time. And if we want to change it, we have to know that, because if you don't know how deep it goes, there's no way you can root it out. There's no way you can change it, because you don't know where it's coming from. And you think that maybe putting a Band-Aid on it is going to do it, or electing a Black president. None of that's going to do it. You know, only the knowledge of how deep it goes is going to get us anywhere.
What kind of repercussions are you talking about? What repercussions do we see here in Wilmington because of 1898?
Well, I mean, I can say that what happened just overall in terms of the destruction of the dream of a multiracial, you know, community, a non-segregated culture, economic situation. I mean, what was going on in Wilmington before the massacre was very hopeful, was very promising, was very much the dream of all those folks, you know, who put their blood, sweat, and tears into Reconstruction before it was deconstructed, which is what happened with Reconstruction. People think, oh, it just failed. It's like, no, it was actually dismantled piece by piece by the folks who wanted to reclaim the power they felt like they were losing. So 1898 is just an outgrowth of that. But what was happening in Wilmington was, you know, a majority Black city that was prospering. There was, you know, a coalition between whites and Blacks that was happening. This is really the dream of the South, you know, for some people, obviously not all, but this was what could have been. This was an example of what, you know, if Reconstruction had been supported correctly and allowed to come to its fruition, what it could have been. And so there was this moment. And the destruction of that moment, you know, for Black culture, for American culture, I think is really, it goes really deep, because then people are like, well, we've never had that. You know, why are you trying to make us do that? Well, we can't do it, or it just can't happen. It's like, actually it did, but it was snuffed out. And then you also have, you know, what the pattern that set up of the, you know, the campaign of intimidation and lies that were told and written that happened as a result of that, you know, to get to where they got to, you know, in the election, around the election of 1898, with using the KKK to intimidate it, using these images, the political cartoons, you know, the perpetuation of these stereotypes of Black people and Black culture and what it was doing to Southern culture and all this kind of stuff. All of this had great damaging effect, I think, on American culture. And it wasn't like it was only happening in Wilmington. Of course, it was happening in places, but it was so successful in Wilmington that then it is, oh, we can do that here. We don't even have to get to where we have to kill people. We can just do it this way. We can, you know, this is the political way to do it. This is the cultural way to do it. We can use the KKK, you know. And so people were like, ah, here we go.
So you're working on this with John Jeremiah Sullivan, mm-hmm. a well-known American writer. What kinds of things are the two of you uncovering? How is that work progressing?
Well,
because there are things like the death toll that we don't really know. Is there new information? You finding new ways to verify facts?
Yeah, I mean, he and his the people who work with him, I mean, he is doing the heavy lifting on that. I mean, he's been researching, he's writing, you know, a piece. He's in control of that information. So whenever he wants to let that out, like, that's his thing. But I can tell you that it's really important stuff. It's stuff that is not in any written history of it, and it's game changing information, you know. And it feels like now's the time, really, you know, for this stuff to come out and for the picture to be to just be fleshed out even more, because there's a lot of people who've done a lot of great work on 1898 already, and there's been some good books and there's been some great documentaries, but there was just so much, I think, so much suppression, and there was so much chaos that it takes a village to tell this story. And now he's doing his piece, which I think is very important, and getting that and incorporating that into the story that we're trying to tell through, you know, the musical piece, I think is going to be, you know, really important.
Do you have main characters yet in your narrative for the musical?
The thing is like the story is so compelling, there's just no need to make up stuff. You know, there's no need to make up people. There's so many interesting characters involved. I mean, obviously, you know, Alexander Manley, and you know, the central is at the central, you know, heart of it. But there are so many interesting people. And what I, my dream for this piece is to really, the dream of Wilmington, the dream of this multiracial society, this sort of beautiful moment is what I want to be at the centerpiece here, you know, and like I want people to feel what we lost in that, you know, because we don't really see that in, you know, in depictions of early American life, depictions of Black life. We don't see, you know, this time period. We don't hear the music. You know, there's a lot of really interesting things going on in American music at this time that we don't really talk about because it's before the, you know, the recording industry really takes off. So there's a lot of opportunity to show not only a beautiful part of American culture, but also a really ugly part of American culture. And they're two sides of the same coin. And so I think that that automatically makes for an incredible dramatic arc, you know. So there's just taking what happened is going to be enough, you know, for the drama, I
think.
Do you
have a target date at this point for when you're going to be finished with the first draft and maybe start workshopping it?
Well, you know, these things take time. And for me, you know, when John has kind of got what he wants, you know, where he, a stopping place for the story that, that this piece of the story that he's sort of fleshing out, that's kind of the ideal time to then really dig into the story. But I'm already setting up like residencies and things, you know, in the following year to go ahead and get the ball rolling, because I don't want it to take too long.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a conversation with MacArthur genius Rhiannon Giddens. When we come back from this break, we'll find out how and why she trained as an opera singer, and we'll hear from some listeners. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's a conversation with Rhiannon Giddens, singer, songwriter, activist, musical historian, and MacArthur Genius Award recipient. She's currently working on a musical in collaboration with writer John Jeremiah Sullivan about the only known coup d'etat in American history, which took place in Wilmington 120 years ago this November. She's also answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Rhiannon Giddens, just before we went to break, you were saying you're looking at residencies now, and there's still so much work to do in terms of getting to the point where you're workshopping this 1898 yeah. musical. Do you have a working title for it, by the way?
I mean, I've been calling it 1898.
Okay,
you know,
that's fair enough.
You know, it's and I have done a little bit. I did a workshop. I'm working with Dirk Powell as well for the music part and the songs and the structure. And we did a residency in New York and wrote a few things that were very exciting. So, you know, it's nice to have a piece or two to kind of
yes.
to go, okay, we have this, and now let's keep going.
And you're talking about workshopping it here in Wilmington, North Carolina.
I would love for, you know, a large part of the creation of it, especially in the beginning, be here, because I just think it's really important. There's, you know, I'm coming in at this point in time, but there's been a lot of people trying to get this story told for a long time, and knowing that it's, you know, the injustice of, you know, the sort of grander ignorance of it in the wider world. And so I think it's really important to form a coalition and to create an artistic community around this, that everybody feels like, okay, you know, obviously we're going to tell the story how we see it, but like if we involve as much of the energy around that as possible, then it's kind of like, I think that's the way, you know, because this is the home of, this is where it happened.
Yeah.
And there's still people here who are descended from people who are involved in that. And so I think it's important to pay honor and homage to all of that, and to, you know, where it makes sense to collaborate as much as possible. You know, you it's at a certain point, the buck stops with you. And as an artist, you have to make decisions, and you have to sort of, you know, shape the story. But I really feel that it would be great to have that have that here, a lot of that happen here.
Now, you have joined something that is essentially an 1898 committee.
Yeah.
Can you, what is the purpose of this committee?
Well, there's a memorial. I know that came, I can't remember when it was put up, but it was some years ago. I can't remember, but it needs a bit of refurbishment. And they're hoping for that to happen. But there's a mission statement, and it's you know, we can't let the 120th anniversary go by without some stuff.
So this committee was formed kind of around the 120th anniversary.
Yeah, I mean, there's been you know, the commemoration of it every year. There's been effort to talk about it and to have things happen. There's been people, you know, sort of slogging through trying to get things to go. But this is specifically for this year. And so I'd like to read the statement that was come up with. I just happened to be in town for this meeting, which is really great.
This is the mission statement. Mm-hmm.
This fall, the 1898 Massacre and Coup d'Etat Observance Committee will commemorate the 120th anniversary of the only forcible takeover of a constitutionally elected government in our nation's history. On November 10th, 1898, the democratically elected Wilmington City Council was violently overthrown by a white supremacist coup comprised of prominent committee members. One witness claimed that over 100 black people were killed. Thousands of others fled into the marsh and cemetery without food or shelter, despite the winter weather, many never to return, and more to die from that time. Beyond the local impact of this tragedy, the state and national repercussions saw the advent of the Jim Crow era. This was characterized by the voter suppression and the economic disenfranchisement many African Americans still feel today. The purpose of this committee, beyond commemorating this historic event, is to call attention to the scope of the destructive aftermath on Wilmington's black community. Through established fact, continued research, and community dialogue, we hope to move toward a more meaningful awareness and reconciliation. This week of observance, beginning November 4th, will be highlighted by community forums, film documentaries, entertainment, and official recognition by local city and county governments.
Excellent. We have a question from Don, and this is why I love our listeners, the way they think and the depth in which they think. Mm-hmm. He writes, in your April 22nd, 2018, All Things Considered interview, thank you for documenting that, Don, you characterized the 1898 Wilmington Massacre as a coup. What challenges do you face to change the current narrative about the 1898 event from a race riot to a massacre and coup d'etat, and in harmony with your theatrical musical endeavor, portray the culture prior to the 1898 event in a positive light?
Well, okay, so there's two parts to that question. One is very simple. Language matters. You know, I just saw an article about this in a reputable newspaper not that long ago that called it a race riot and didn't mention anybody was killed. And I was like, that's irresponsible, because what happens is it diminishes and downplays, you know, what happened. And so when you hear race riot, it takes us back to our president saying there's good people on both sides. It's like, this is not an equal situation. This is not people coming at each other 50-50.
You're referring to the violence in Charlottesville,
yes,
Virginia.
And, you know, this is institutional. This is called, I mean, it's just, it's enormous. And when you have the amount of people that were killed, it that is the definition of a massacre. And when you have something that never happened anywhere else but is a forcible takeover of a government, a federal, you know, elected government, that is a coup d'etat. So you have to call it those things, because that gives it the severity that it is, and it gives it the solemnity that it is, you know. And to answer the other part of that, I am so obsessed with presenting the beauty of our mixed culture, because, you know, we see the benefits of that in our music and our dance and things like that. But we tend to, like, in African American, you know, studies, like, you know, in school, it was like, okay, emancipation. And the next thing we learn is the Harlem Renaissance. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, there's a long time in between that formed all of the bedrock that then that explosion in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, you know, comes from. And it's like, there are some really beautiful stories that need to be highlighted. There's a beautiful culture that it wasn't completely destroyed. It just, you know, went underground, or it sort of, you know, melded and happened and went here and there. And so it's like, I think this is a great opportunity to, as I said before, to showcase that moment and for people to go, this is not a fantasy. This was actually happening.
You talk a lot about individual narratives and the importance of individual stories, whether you're talking about 1898 or whether you're talking about the experiences of people who were slaves. And you have a song called At the Purchaser's Option, which we'll hear in a moment. But just talk to me first about individual narrative and why you think that's so important. Why is this woman's story important?
Because this woman could be, I could be this woman. There are people now who are this woman. You know what I mean? It's like we, when somebody murders somebody else, we put them in jail forever. When somebody murders 20 million people, they get house arrest. You know what I mean? It's like we cannot comprehend the size of all of millions of people or even thousands of people. But you give us one story and we put ourselves in that woman's shoes. And that's how we comprehend the pain. And that's how we comprehend what's happening. And that's why music and stories and songs are so important, because that's what a song can do, is to put you in that place. That's what a good movie can do, is to put you in that person's place, not in 500 people's place, because we can't, our brains don't work that way. You know, we need that one journey, and then you can extrapolate that and go, oh wow, you know, but you have to have the one first.
In this song, At the Purchaser's Option, this is inspired by a 19th century advertisement that you found. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that ad.
Yeah, I was just looking. I'm always looking at, you know, the computers and internet. It has a boon to people like me now. I can look at people's archives, you know, that are hundreds of miles or thousands of miles away. And I found this ad, and it was just a very common thing. I mean, there were ads for people all in every newspaper in the country. You know,
ads for people. You mean for people
for
selling people?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was like a used car. You put an ad in the paper, and it was just like this. What people don't understand is that we were cash. You know what I mean? When you needed some money, you sold somebody. That's the way it was. And it's such a huge story that hasn't been told, really, the economic impact of slavery. But, I mean, it has been told, but you know what I mean? In popular consciousness, I don't think it really has. And I looked at this ad, and I was just kind of thinking that. And then I got to that line of, she has with her a 9-month-old baby who is at the purchaser's option. And I was just like, you know, oh my God. You know, here's this woman who is for sale. And that, if that's not bad enough, you add to it the family destruction that happened over and over again during slavery. And this was an excellent example of that. It's like, she has no idea. And I just was like, what is it like being her? To wake up and go, I have a baby. I had two children. I nursed them both. I still have them. I nursed them both. And I was just thinking of my nursing 9-month-old to not know any day whether that baby was going to get taken away from me. And it just broke my heart. And this song came about because it was like, what kind of strength does it take? Now, see, that's the issue for me in terms of slavery times. It's like, we talk a lot about all the horrible things, but like, what kind of strength does it take to make it through that? You know, how the creation of African American culture is one of survival and thriving. It is not one of destruction and slavery. You know, we weren't slaves, we were enslaved. That's a really important distinction as well. So this woman, what did it take for her to get up every day, you know, and not to just lay down and just die? Like, what did it take? And so that's where the song came from.
Let's listen.
I've got a babe, but shall I keep him? 'Twill come the day when I'll be weeping. But how can I love him any less? This little babe upon my breast. You can take my body, you can take my
Rhiannon Giddens singing at the Purchaser's Option. That's from her most recent solo album, Freedom Highway. You can ask your own question of Rhiannon Giddens on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Don from Southport, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, Rachel and Rhiannon. Excuse me. I have a question, but I want to let Rhiannon know my wife and I walked the Camino de Santiago in Spain this May. And while we walked the 10 to 18 miles a day, when things started to drag, we sang Up Above My Head, and it was a real lift, and I wanted to thank you for bringing that song back.
Oh, that's wonderful.
My question is whether or not we'll see characters in your musical from the novel The Marrow of Tradition. And if so, how difficult is it going to be to include the really rich and varied dialects from that book?
I'm sorry, Don, I don't think we understood your question. Characters in what?
The novel, The Marrow of Tradition, which I had heard in an earlier interview that Rhiannon had, had referenced as one of the part of the research for the play.
I'm not getting the
name
of
the book.
Is there
a novel that you have used as research for the 1898 musical?
I'm looking at the sort of essays in the history. The history books at the moment.
Yeah.
I didn't understand the name, though. I still am not
getting the name one more time, Don.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. Yes, it's a novel that was based on 1898. It's called The Marrow of Tradition, written by Charles Chestnut.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's like when you're creating a story, it's like to get the facts and then knowing where you can take dramatic license and then trying to get a feel for the time period, absolutely all of anything that was written in that time, the letters we have, Alexander Manley's wife's letters that talk about, to get the flavor of not only the way of speech from that time, but also the people who were living in that time and some of the characters who are going to be in the story. All of that is super, super important because I think, the more that you can infuse it with that, the more specific you can make it, the bigger of an impact it can have. So, I mean, as much of that as possible, for sure.
Don, thank you so much for your question. We had John from Wilmington call in and ask, does Ms. Giddens see the path forward to establishing community relationships post-1898? Does she see economic and socially progressive policies that help African Americans move forward to start this healing?
I mean, do I see them now? Not now, no. What I see is a lot of people who are becoming aware of the depth of the issue. I see people who are becoming aware of, the history that's going on, and people who are kind of going, oh, I didn't really realize it went back this far. And that's really promising to me because that's what it's going to take is everybody together. This is not like black people doing this and white people. The point is that we all have to do it together because it's all of our history and we all benefit from it in different ways. And I think that is the only way forward is through a coalition of people. But we have to get the education out there.
Jacob from Wilmington called in, and we'll actually get to some other questions that we have via email about some of your songs.
Sure.
But this is really interesting to me that a lot of our listeners are so interested in the racial divide here and the lingering impacts of 1898. And Jacob asks, years ago, when Cape Fear Rising came out, that is a historical work of fiction by Philip Gerard, they named a road in Wilmington Martin Luther King Highway. Why didn't they name it Alex Manley, he asks. And of course, Alex Manley, for those who don't know, was the publisher of the only Black-owned newspaper at the time. Gary from Wilmington asks, I would like our local youth to know that the two cultures worked together in 1898, prominent whites and blacks alike. He says, I want young black Wilmingtonians to know their history and be proud of the black academics and politicians that were here. Why aren't there monuments to the prominent white and black politicians of 1898, the ones who were working toward a multicultural society?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. It's a very good question. I mean, when you realize what happened in 1898 and the power and economic power that was broken, you know, when you realize what happened to the people who took over those offices and who took the power, where they ended up, and the people who were run out. You're run out of your community. You're run out of where you have roots, where you have your business, where you have all of your connections, and you have to start over somewhere else. Then, you know, how do you come back and say, let's make a statue? You know what I mean? It's very difficult. So this is why to get the knowledge and the story out there so that we can come together and make restitution, because it's like there's lots of Confederate soldiers out there who have set statues because the people who had money are the ones who put them up. So we need to absolutely fix that.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with Rhiannon Giddens, co-founder of the Carolina Chocolate Drops 2017 MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. She's working on a musical about Wilmington's coup d'etat of 1898. And we are going to talk about her most recent album, solo album, Freedom Highway. You can ask your own question of Rhiannon Giddens on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Alvin writes, her song Tomorrow Is My Turn has two versions. On my CD, it's just Rhiannon singing normally. On Spotify, her voice is dubbed in a second time to form a round. Both versions have been posted by fans on YouTube. I cannot find an explanation or discussion of the two versions. Without hearing the song, there's no way to identify which one you have. Is it just potluck when you buy a recording, he asks. And you're giving me a look like you have no idea what he's talking about.
I don't know. Around? Okay. I'll have to go investigate. I mean, I know what I put on the record. I know what T-Bone, you know, signed up on. So, which is just me singing it, you know, sort of normal. I don't know. I'll have to go look now.
Jim wants to know if he's going to get some cornbread and butter beans tonight. What are the chances?
I would have to say zero chances on the cornbread and butter beans,
sorry,
unless you go to a restaurant.
That,
I'm sorry.
Okay. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're meeting Rhiannon Giddens, who is performing tonight, and I'm assuming that's a reference to one of your songs. Performing tonight at UNCW's Keenan Auditorium at 7:30 as part of the Lumina Festival of the Arts. Ask your own question of Rhiannon on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this short break, we'll have one more segment for you to get your own question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, it's an exploration with Rhiannon Giddens, MacArthur Genius Fellow. You may know her from the Carolina Chocolate Drops. That group was inducted into the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame in 2016. She's currently collaborating with writer John Jeremiah Sullivan on a musical about the coup d'etat that happened in 1898. Right here in Wilmington, North Carolina. She's also performing tonight at UNCW's Keenan Auditorium at 7:30 as part of the Lumina Festival of the Arts. You can ask your own question of Rhiannon Giddens on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question in. Rhiannon, Fred writes, has the research led to, and he's talking about 1898 research, has it led to where burials may have taken place? Oak Grove Cemetery is a place once called Potter's Field. I've done some research lately for other purposes. A memorial garden type of thing may help bring back the accurate history of the massacre.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an amazing idea. I think that, you know, to honor the loss, you know, it's just really hard. The research that has been done and is continuing to be done, trying to find out, there was no interest in accurately writing down who died. People were just, you know, either nameless or, you know, so trying to penetrate that is really hard. But I think cleaning up that cemetery where so many of the prominent African American people in Wilmington are buried is absolutely imperative, you know, and that's the kind of thing that's out of my purview, you know. It's like, but bringing attention to what happened through the through music any way that I can, hopefully will then raise the profile of what happened so that people, you know, who could donate the money for that or who could get involved with that would do that. But I think that's absolutely imperative, yeah.
Bri writes, I really love banjo music from Western North Carolina. Are you inspired at all by music from that region?
Western North Carolina? I mean, sure. I sing every night. I sing, you know, ballads I learned from Sheila K. Adams, you know, who's from Western North Carolina. I've learned loads of tunes from the Appalachians. And, I mean, obviously my focus has been on the Piedmont area because it is an underrepresented area in banjo music. But, yeah, I mean, it's hard to be a banjo player and not be inspired by the West.
Kim writes, bravo, can't wait for the show tonight. Something to pass you once we're not on the air again. I want to get to the fact that you started out, you studied opera.
Mm-hmm.
You imagined yourself at one point being an opera singer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where did that come from?
When the bug bit me to sing, you know, I'd been singing as a kid my whole life and singing with my family. But then I just, I want to sing. I was in governor's school here in North Carolina for chorus. And I found my tribe. And I was like, they don't talk in opera. It's like ironic, you know, because I hated talking on stage. I didn't want to talk on stage. So I didn't want to do musicals. So I went into opera because they don't talk. They just sing, you know. I had no idea how hard it was. And I loved it. I mean, I did many operas when I was in school. And I, you know, I've sung now with symphony. And I've still done a bit of classical, you know, pieces, you know, interspersed in there. I still have a voice teacher, and I love it. You know, it just wasn't the path that, you know, I was supposed to take. But I'm glad I can incorporate it some now into what I'm doing, which is fabulous because I do love that kind of singing.
How did you connect to that path that you were supposed to take? How did you get to the point where you could listen to that inner song deeply enough to hear it and kind of follow it in your life?
I was very blessed. You know, I got my training and then I kind of burned out on that scene, that which is very, you have to be very, very sort of confident in being a star, being a diva, you know, to really make it in that world. And that's kind of not my personality. And so when I came back to North Carolina and discovered folk music and then discovered the history of the banjo, That and discovering Joe Thompson and, you know, who is the last living African-American fiddler of the old tradition, that like vast string, black string band tradition that is, you know, almost disappeared now, but was so important. Making that personal connection, you know, he lived in Mebane, which is where I went for family reunions every year, you know, it's like so North Carolina and so such an important piece of history. And that's kind of where I started finding my mission of, people got to know this. This is really important. I see how this affects our culture and how this affects, you know, our knowledge of history. And, you know, that's pretty much, that was it in the formation of the Carolina Chocolate Drops. And, you know, finding a mission that's bigger than myself was absolutely the best thing that could have happened to me in music, because I just don't believe in, I'm not interested in this for my own sort of, you know, aggrandizement. I'm really, if it will help the mission, I will do it. If wearing makeup on TV will help the mission, I will do it. Otherwise, I don't mess with it. You know, it's not about me. It's about the stories that I feel like I've been chosen to be a conduit for, or to tell, or to highlight.
The money from the foundation, going back to your MacArthur Award, is a no strings attached situation. There are no reporting requirements, and the MacArthur Foundation explains this very clearly. However you use the money, the philosophy is that will presumably help you express more of your genius, whether you use it to hire staff for this 1898 musical project or whether you use it to hire a nanny. Mm-hmm. The philosophy is it's yours to help expedite your creative process. When you first heard about this award, well, tell us about your reaction to it, first of all. Did you even know that you were being considered for this?
I had no clue. I mean, of course, they come out every year, and every year you go, God, what I wouldn't do for one of those, you know. But you just kind of go on about your business. And I got that phone call, and I couldn't believe it. I was in a spot where I was just very, very stressed and down and just like, is anybody listening? Like, because what I've basically been doing is using a solo career to push things that really usually are grant funded, you know, an album about like civil rights. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like I've never written grants. I've never been in that world, but I've used sort of my voice and that opportunity to push, you know, the mission. And that's hard to make commercial music that is, you know, minded to tell these stories. You know, I don't have any radio play. Like, I work very, very hard. And when that call came in, it was like, oh my God, I can relax for a second. You know, I won't, but but you know what I mean? I can actually prioritize things based on, you know, the projects and all of, you know, and I don't have to worry about so much keeping the lights on. That's going to be taken care of. And I can follow these things, you know, without, you know, feeling completely stressed out all the time, which is kind of a death to art, really, you know. And I was getting to that point of like, how am I going to do this? How do I keep doing this? You know, what's the next step? I don't know. And then I got the phone call.
That must have felt like such an affirmation of what you were doing.
I mean, I tell people, I'm like, the money, of course, is very important. You know, it's paid out over 5 years, which I think is really, really smart. You know, so it just gives you those bursts so that you can, you know, do these things. But really, like, reading what they said and just knowing that all these really smart, cool people, like, you know, thought that about what I did. I mean, you just kind of put your head down and you do what you think you're supposed to be doing, and you do what you think is right. And when you have that moment of lifting it up and kind of going, oh, wow, people are paying attention. I mean, it's important to have those moments, because otherwise you get discouraged, you know.
It sounds like you didn't really discover what you identify as your mission until after Oberlin. And when you were into your adult years, this wasn't like maybe the musical fire was always burning within you, but it wasn't this, like bringing these cultures together and exposing and telling the stories of people that haven't been told. How did you come across that? You are multiracial yourself, biracial. How do you identify?
I identify as like North Carolinian, you know? Like, I really feel like our culture is a mixed culture. I feel like Southern culture is mixed culture. You know, there is no white Southern culture and black Southern culture. There's just Southern culture, you know? And the people who exemplify it look different. I mean, I really believe that. And, you know, there's aspects that are more attached to certain kinds of people than other or whatever. But like, overall, it's a mixed culture, you know, and I like that, because I spent so many years not knowing what box to check. And I hate it. You know, race is BS anyway. It's constructed to keep certain people down and to raise other people and create an economic system that benefits just some. And so I'm not interested in perpetuating that.
I want to get to the title track of your most recent solo album, Freedom Highway. We're coming down near the end of the show, and let's just go ahead and listen, and then you can tell us what.
There's just one thing I can't understand, my friend. Why some folks think freedom is not designed for all men.
There are so many people living their lives perplexed.
Title track from Rhiannon Giddens' most recent solo album, Freedom Highway. Where did that come from, Rhiannon?
That's a pop staple song, you know, it's from the 60s. And it's like, yes, we are still singing songs from the 60s, you know. But it's a great song. It's like, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on, but the only way is forward. And the only way is together, you know, and not being turned around or distracted from, yes, we've got a better world to build.
We had a call from Dawn. She asks, will Rhiannon collaborate with Alison Krauss? And our producer writes, she was crying on the phone about how much she loves Rhiannon.
Well, I will collaborate with anybody who wants to collaborate. I mean, obviously I love Alison. She's a beautiful singer. And I feel like, that I think, I feel like there's more of that in my future, I hope, you know. I've been so focused on on these stories, you know. It'd be nice at some point to be able to kind of go, let's just do a song because it's pretty. And, you know, our voices sound good together. I could use a little bit of that, you know, I'd say.
It's so much a part of your mission is telling the stories of actual people and bringing history to life. And yet, and that's writing. That is songwriting. Mm-hmm. And yet at one point you said, I'm more of a singer than a songwriter. What's up with that? What do you mean by that?
You know, we grow, we change. I still feel like I'm more of a singer, but it is changing. You know, my how I look at myself. You know, T-Bone Burnett had a big part in that, pushing me out there and making me kind of go, oh, actually I can write. And, you know, I don't know how good it is or whatever, but I'm writing to a purpose, and that's all I care about, you know. And if it's serving the purpose, now I'm writing speeches and giving speeches. I'm like, where did that come from, you know? But there's so much to do and there's so much to say, and if that's helpful, I'll do it. Basically, if it's helpful, I'll do it. If I can tell a story in a way that, you know, I have a platform to tell it, I'll do it.
What's the state of the Carolina Chocolate Drops now? Is that a closed chapter, or will there be more?
You know, it right now it feels like that band is resting, and it's, you know, it is where it is, you know, and Dom Flemons is doing great work, and Justin's, you know, deep in the food ways of North Carolina, and I'm doing what I'm doing, and everybody who's been a part of that, you know, Rowan and Malcolm and Hubby, we've all, you know, are doing these great things, and I think as a concept it should always be there, you know. And if one day we can roll it back out and figure out a way that it makes sense to do, of course. But right now, you know, you have to follow. We all put a lot of years into the Chocolate Drops, and you have to follow where your art is leading you, you know. And right now it feels like I'm in the zone of where I need to be doing, you know. But I don't like to close any doors, you know. Chocolate Drops is very, very dear to me, and I know also to Dom and Justin and everybody else who is a part of it. So I'm very protective of it. So if it comes back, it's going to be in the right way.
You tweeted not so long ago that when the headlines distress you, you go to your knitting.
I do.
When did you learn to knit, and what are you working on now?
I learned to knit as an adult, you know, because I'm left-handed and dyslexic, so it took me, I had to figure out how to do it. But I, as a college student, and I would knit, I'd go to the operas and I'd knit. I'm such a throwback nerd. But yeah, I knit kids' sweaters and blankets, and, you know, I've only knit socks a couple times. It's a great way to, I like doing things with my hands. You know, I'm not really into a lot of passive sort of, you know, watching TV or whatever. I like to create things and know that 2 hours, at the end of the 2 hours, I got, you know, 5 inches longer in my blanket. That makes me happy. And it, you know, lets my brain kind of turn off a little bit.
You wrote a poem or a song when Robin Williams died by suicide. And then you tweeted it after Anthony Bourdain died by suicide this past June. We have just a minute or so left, but can you tell us a little bit about this poem?
Yeah. I wrote it because, you know, a lot of artists know this feeling, the two sides, the dark and the light. And I've had very dark moments. And so this poem just kind of came out of me. And just seemed to strike a chord with people. So I reposted it.
Is that something that you'll make into a song?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. My poetry writing and my songwriting, I find are different. They're very, the cadences are very different and they feel different. So it might be something I could do in collaboration with someone else. You know, we'll see.
Can you read us just a couple of stanzas?
Sure. I darkly go where you can't reach the depths of viscous shadow. I curl myself and grit my teeth of what it does not matter. I only know I have no claim of conscious choice or need. This suffocation has no name, nor patronage, nor creed. I yearn to tell you how it is trapped in this horrid dance. But love, what makes me saddest is I'll never get the chance. Makes me cry.
Thank you for that. That's this edition of Coastline. Rats-a-roni. Rhiannon Giddens, thank you so much for being with us today. What a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager, Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.